The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today. This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation. The post office takes way too much time, and a postage meter is pretty expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way, Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code Undisclosed for this special offer. You get a four-week trial and $110 in bonuses, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com and enter Undisclosed. Hi and welcome to another special episode of Undisclosed. This week's episode is Making a Murderer. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor and blogger at the Evidence Prof blog. This week, all three of us are here because this is something all three of us wanted to talk about. Late last year, the documentary series Making a Murderer set the real crime scene on fire. The series covered the investigation and conviction of Stephen Avery, a man from Manitowoc County, Wisconsin, for the murder of Teresa Halbach in 2005. For those of our listeners who have not seen the series, I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on the case. Teresa Halbach was a 25-year-old woman who worked for the publication Auto Trader. You've probably seen the Auto Trader magazines at your local grocery store. They're basically a collection of local auto classified ads. On Halloween Day, October 31st, 2005, Teresa had a number of appointments with clients who needed pictures of their cars taken and their ads submitted. So she took off in her 1999 Toyota RAV for the three appointments that she had that day. She never made it back from those appointments. One of those appointments was to photograph a car on the Avery property because Avery had specifically requested her to come out. Now, the Avery family owned and operated a sprawling auto salvage yard, and many of the family members lived in homes on that property. Stephen Avery himself lived in a trailer just a few hundred feet away from his sister Barb's home. Barb's 16-year-old son, Brendan Dassey, also ended up being charged with Teresa's murder. Not long after Teresa disappeared, evidence of her remains, burned and charred, were found on Avery's property. So was her car, with Avery's blood in it. Avery already had a history with the law, with burglary, animal cruelty in which he soaked a cat in gasoline and set it on fire, running his own cousin, who happened to be married to a county sheriff's deputy, off the road, indecency, and even allegations of rape and sexual abuse on his record. So, given the evidence and also Avery's background, charging him with Teresa's murder seemed like an open and shut case. But here's the rub. In 1985, Avery had been charged with a brutal rape and attempted murder of a woman named Penny Bierenstein. And Bierenstein herself actually identified Avery as her assailant. But Avery maintained his innocence, and after serving 18 years for this crime, it turned out that he actually was. Avery was exonerated of the crime after DNA evidence proved that another man named Gregory Allen, a convicted offender in multiple other charges, had been the one to rape and assault Bierenstein. After being exonerated in 2003, Avery filed a lawsuit against Manitowoc County, the sheriff, and the prosecutor for their misconduct and their hand in his wrongful conviction. So when he was arrested in 2005 for Teresa's murder, he was actually awaiting judgment on a $36 million claim. If he hadn't been arrested in this new crime, who knows how much he could have recovered. He was, though, and while in prison, as he awaited trial in Teresa's murder, He was awarded $400,000 for the wrongful conviction for the 18 years he had served, which was a fraction of his lawsuit demand. But it was enough to help them hire some really strong defense attorneys, Dean Strang and Jerry Buting. Unfortunately for Avery, who has always maintained his innocence, he was still convicted and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole in 2007.
So I should probably start off by saying where we all are in terms of the show. I started watching it in very early January. I took like 2 months to finish it because I just couldn't handle it. I'd watch an episode a week and then it was enough for me. It made me think a lot about our show and I'm like, why do we have listeners? This is painful. I don't like it. I wanted to know what happened, but I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. It was not an enjoyable experience. I kind of would have preferred just to read the documents and not be forced to sit through and watch it. And not because it was bad, just because I didn't, you know, it's terrible and I felt helpless, and towards the end, they start saying, like, what they're going to do, what the plans are, and then it's on a better note. First, like, maybe half and then some was just all the bad stuff without any sort of route out of the darkness.
I actually binge-watched it. I waited till it was over, and I watched the whole thing, I think, in 2 days or something, and I was really drawn in. At the same time, I know, because it was, I was actually traveling. I was overseas when it had aired here. So by the time I got back and got to watch it, there was already a lot in the media about like the things that the filmmakers had missed or they didn't stress or they deliberately downplayed. So I had that also kind of in the back of my mind. And I think Kathleen Zellner had already gotten involved. So I kind of knew what was happening in the case, like in terms of like there was a petition that was launched. I knew that there was a lot of activity happening to try to right some of the wrongs that people perceived. It's a deeply disturbing story just from his previous wrongful conviction. You know, it's interesting. I grew up in a lot of rural areas and I feel like I've known families like this, right? I don't know. I feel like I get how like a community or an agency, like a law enforcement agency, could find it easy to railroad people in certain, in communities, because it's always the people who are the most vulnerable in that community. They don't have to necessarily be people of color or this or that. I mean, it could just be the people who are the most easy to pick on, kind of. That's what stuck out to me. But, you know, when I went into this, there are so many people also saying that it's all BS. He's actually guilty and this documentary's not fair.
Yeah, imagine if Avery hadn't had any money, if he hadn't had a settlement.
Right.
He would have been easy to steamroll. It would have been easy as could be. The only reason there's even enough of a record here to make a fight out of it is because he did have enough money to hire attorneys who were not completely incompetent. And you mentioned earlier about Zellner already being involved. I wonder when she got in, because as I was watching it, I already knew she was involved and I knew kind of what she was looking at. And I remember the last episode made me think they were already talking in sort of veiled terms to things that Zellner was doing.
I mean, what I understand is that he wrote to her. He saw her on TV and he wrote to her and said, you know, would you take my case? But I just don't know what the timeline is on it. Colin, have you watched the series?
I watched the first episode and read some of the prior opinions and things online, and I just thought this is another rabbit hole I can't go down. I'm just so deep into Adnan's case and then season two that I find it very interesting. It led in Wisconsin and nationwide to a lot of interesting new legal rules, but it's something where I've almost consciously decided I'm not going to delve into the rest of the episodes because there's just so much there and so much to keep straight.
Yeah, I did the same. I watched the episodes, but I had to very intentionally and forcibly say, nope, not looking into this. I started to go down that hole, and then I just kind of said, nope, can't do it. Especially now that we're in the full throes of the next case. There's no answers here. They didn't bother to nail down basic facts. So any attempt to investigate it requires like an overhaul of everything. You can't just dabble in this one. You have to learn all the holes from the ground up. That was a terrible analogy.
Well, I mean, I actually can see the difference now, because I think for you and Colin, when you started watching the series, you felt this compulsion that this needs like investigation, this needs more scrutiny, whereas I just consumed it like most consumers. I did not once go then look for the documents, go to Reddit. I watched it and I walked away. I just read some of the news articles about Zellner and stuff and the pop media stuff, probably because I'm, like you said, we're all drawn into, you know, the other cases. But I can see why you and Colin were like, can't do this, because I think you two both feel a compulsion like you have to go deeper.
Well, I feel like he's in good hands with Zellner there.
Yeah.
I feel like we'll get answers eventually.
She's fascinating.
I mean, Robbie, I put together a timeline and an outline of the episode, and I'm looking at it now, and I just keep thinking, like, well, yes, they said that, but why do we know that? And why do we know this? And as far as I can remember, I remember the show saying these facts. I remember this being a thing, but I don't recall them ever saying why it was a thing or why it was definitely this and not something else. Like with the phone logs, they only got like one kind of subscriber activity report. I don't think they got her actual phone bill. I'm not sure about that. Maybe they got a voicemail log or something. But the report they got was not a complete report. It wasn't the kind of report that necessarily has all the call data. Very often those kinds of reports specifically leave out certain kinds of calls. So to my knowledge, I don't know if we can even say with certainty that this is the complete activity on our phone that day.
Well, it might not be the complete activity, but the calls that are that we know happened are what we can document, right? I mean, so for example, we know that at 8:12 a.m. on October 31st, 2005, that Stephen Avery made a call to AutoTrader. There are specific calls that we can definitely say happened because those records do exist. The calls, obviously, that we don't know that happened, I mean, if those records don't exist, they don't exist. And a lot of things, for example, the things that people saw, it comes either from the testimony or the police statement. And I basically use like five or six different sources to try to cross-reference and corroborate the statements.
So we know for a fact that that morning, Avery calls AutoTrader. Does he call Teresa directly or does he call AutoTrader?
No, he actually calls AutoTrader early in the morning and he's calling on behalf of his sister Barb, who has a van for sale. And he's saying, can you send the last girl who came last time? And apparently Teresa Halbach had been to their property. She works for AutoTrader. She'll go out to different properties and she'll photograph cars and submit the advertisement for them to sell them, and she would get paid sometimes like in cash, but you know, about $40 for each gig. And she had been, according to Stephen Avery, to their property about a dozen times, maybe up to 15 times before, so she knew the property. But he had called that morning saying, can you have that girl come out who's come out before? And then he left his sister's name and number and said this is the contact person because it was her car. So a couple of hours later, we know that Teresa at 11:43 calls Barb, which is Stephen Avery's sister, and leaves a voicemail saying that she can come after 2:00. She has two other appointments. There's an appointment at a property owned by somebody named Schmidt, and then Zipperer. Now, apparently her appointments with these two properties are before Stephen Avery's. I don't know what the source of that is, but there also seems to be confusion about whether or not she went to do the Zipperer property before or after Avery, and that comes from a police conversation that was recorded where there's a discussion that she might have gone to see the Zipperer property afterwards, and also because the woman who lives at the Zipperer property, the wife, the mother, says she saw Teresa at her property as late as 3:30 p.m., and that was in her initial police reports, but then later at trial, the prosecutor got her to move the timeline up. And that's significant because it depends on like who was the last person, what was the last property that she visited? Was it the Avery property or was it the Zipperer property? And that's really important in this case.
This is one of the first things I started to look at, and I kind of backed away slowly and like, nope, can't do this. Because I kind of assumed from making a murderer that they more or less knew the order or where she'd been kind of, sorta, until about 2:30. But it doesn't seem like that at all. It seems like they got a bunch of possibilities still sitting out there. They've kind of nailed them together.
Yeah.
The first one, right, that's certain. The Schmidt's one?
The Schmidt's one's certain.
Didn't that cancel or something?
I don't think it was canceled. I think she actually showed up to take a picture. For some reason, everybody seems to agree that that was a definite 1:30 p.m. appointment. So at 2:27, and she still hasn't gotten, she had told Barb she's going to be there up to 2 at the Avery residence. She had not gotten there by 2. And so at 2:27, AutoTrader called Teresa and said that, like, where are you? How come you haven't reached the Avery property? Because apparently Stephen Avery had been calling and asking. And he also, and this is one thing that people say it's really kind of shady, is that between 2:12 and 2:35, Stephen Avery called Teresa's cell phone with his number blocked.
Why is that even shady, though? People do that all the time.
People do that. It's just one of those things, like so many other things in other cases, where people look at this and if you think he's guilty, you're like, well, this points to him.
Why would it help him kill her? Like, why is that part of a murder plot?
I totally agree. But the point is he is looking for her. So he's looking for her. He probably called AutoTrader. They called her at 2:27 and she told them, I'm 10 minutes away from the Avery property.
Do we actually know that, though? This is another thing I was looking at. And I remember somehow the woman she was talking to testified that Teresa called her, but that wasn't true. So are we even sure that's the right time or the right call?
The 2:27 p.m. call?
Yeah.
So there seems to be a 2:27 to 2:32 incoming call from AutoTrader, according to her records.
Do we know that, though, for sure?
I mean, I'm assuming that's just been stipulated, too, because the records reflect it.
See, now I want to dive back into it, and I shouldn't.
You know what? I'm going to leave all the cell phone stuff to you, Susan. But at 2:27, the conversation happened one way or the other. And at that point, Teresa had not reached Stephen Avery's property. But she said she would be there in about 10 minutes. So that would put her arriving at the property around 2:40 p.m. that afternoon. According to Stephen Avery, she came, she spent about 10, 15 minutes there. He paid her and she left. That's what he said. She didn't spend much time there. There are other folks on the property, and the property has numerous trailers. The family lives in different trailers. One of those trailers is Stephen Avery's sister, Barb's, and her sons live there. One of the sons is Bobby Dassey. So Bobby also says that he was in his trailer and he was sleeping around that time, but when he got out, he looked at the window, he went outside, and he said he saw Teresa there around the same time too, between 2:30 and 3 is what he remembers. Now, here's where things get weird. Okay, so Bobby then was going to go hunting. He leaves home, and he was seen driving away from the property by somebody who was coming to the property named Scott Tadich. So that kind of confirms that we know around 3 o'clock he had already left the property, which means he saw Teresa before that. But here's the weird thing. 3:40 p.m., the school bus arrives, and the school bus brings home Brendan and Blaine Dassey. They are Bobby's brothers. And the bus driver of that school bus testified that she saw Teresa taking pictures of the car at this time, at 3:40 p.m., which is like way off on the timeline, as you would expect it to be because of what Teresa told Auto Trader and what both Stephen and Bobby are saying they saw her.
See, I'm not buying that first. It bothers me. The timeline of when they actually started talking to people mm-hmm. and when these statements came about doesn't seem like it was designed to get authentic answers about what was done when.
And Susan, I'm looking to what you said before. That 227 call, I guess, was supposedly by Dawn at Auto Trader, but she said she left a voicemail and didn't actually talk to Teresa. It's not on the call like identified. It's an incoming call, but the duration is 4 minutes and 45 seconds, which would be inconsistent with a voicemail. So, yeah, there is a big question mark there, whether that actually was a call from Auto Trader, and then if not, who, in fact, made that call.
Oh, yeah, this case is rife with contradictory and inconsistent statements from, like, the same witnesses. This will happen again.
The website I got this from is the George Zipperer Blogspot, and then that notes on there about, on November 3rd, how the Zipperers were called twice to confirm that Teresa was there on the day that she disappeared, and there's question marks about whether they lied to the police about whether she visited the property or whether there's confusion. There's just so many questions about this timeline. It's maddening.
It reminds me of Hayes' case in that they were so focused on a suspect, they forgot to ever look at the basic facts concerning the victim. Just basic timeline, basic information about her, computer records. They just didn't record these basic details because they were so focused on a suspect that we no longer have access to them today.
And I think this is what Zellner is going to be doing going forward. They're going to be dismantling these cases and poking holes in all of them. I mean, exactly bringing up what you're saying, Susan. This is kind of like the official story at this point. And Brendan, who arrived on the school bus with his brother Blaine, becomes very instrumental in this case in terms of helping to convict Stephen Avery and also implicate himself in the murder. Brendan said that he came home from school that day around 3:40 p.m. When the police later are asking people that, you know, have you talked to her, seen her, anybody know where she is, says he has no idea, like, anything about Teresa. So if the bus driver is saying that she saw Teresa, well, Brendan apparently did not see Teresa. Brendan then says that he went home, he played video game, he watched TV until 7 o'clock. His brother left to go trick-or-treating around 5:15 p.m., so Brendan was home alone. At one point, his mom came home briefly and saw Brendan there, and then she left. And according to Brendan, around 7 o'clock, Stephen Avery calls Brendan and says, "Do you want to come over for a bonfire?" And so Brendan goes over, and they take a little tractor trailer, and they drive around the property, and they pick up all this garbage to put in the bonfire, and then they go and light a bonfire. In the meantime, Stephen Avery says that he basically had paid Teresa. She left and he went back to his trailer. At some point around 5 o'clock, his mother came to give him his mail. There is apparently a 4:35 p.m. call from Avery's phone to Teresa's phone, and this time the number's not blocked. And between 5:30 and 6 p.m., Avery's girlfriend, Jody Stachowski, who is actually in prison at the time, calls him from the prison, and she makes a 15-minute call to Avery. According to her testimony and statements, she said they had a normal conversation. He didn't seem like he was in a rush, and nothing seemed amiss to her. That was back then. She is saying something very different now. And then there's a call from Stephen to his brother, Chuck Avery, around 6. So there's a lot of phone activity right now.
Well, we all know from Anand's case that murderers regularly take breaks to make random phone calls.
They make a lot of phone calls. Look, according to the state's case, by the time his girlfriend calls from the prison, he should have well been into either torturing her or hurting her or doing something to her, and it would be very odd to stop and take a 15-minute phone call. So at 7:45 p.m., Brenda's mom comes back, and she's dropped off by that same guy, Scott, who had earlier seen her other son, Bobby, leave the property at 3 p.m., and she sees both Brendan and Avery next to a bonfire. And a little bit later, Barb gives Avery a call and says, can you just send Brendan home by 10 p.m.?
So, of course, I mean, this whole story comes from the whole torturing and whatever timeline comes from Brendan Dassey, who gave a textbook false confession. And not textbook, because it became something far worse than the typical false confession when his own attorney contributed to it and basically coerced him into giving another one and then put him in front of investigators without an attorney present to do it again. That part's on textbook, but everything Brendan said is false. Everyone knows that what Brendan said was false. There's no one that I'm aware of who thinks that what Brendan said has any basis in reality, because it doesn't. I mean, it's a nonsensical, childlike story.
Yeah, I mean, Colin, have you seen the interviews of Brendan, the police interrogation video?
I've seen some of it. I don't think all of it, but I've seen some of it. And yeah, as Susan says, you can very well believe that Stephen Avery is guilty, but it is not based upon a narrative presented by Dassey. That quote-unquote confession is, as Susan says, just textbook for, you know, correcting misstatements, feeding information. This is clearly an individual who does not have a high IQ. His attorney, from all the filings, was almost an arm of the state. Everything, sort of the perfect storm coming together to produce this false confession.
And I think in one of his first tape videos, he's alone without an attorney being interrogated by police. At the end of it, the police kind of made it seem like, oh yeah, we just want to get this information, then you'll go home. But of course, he didn't. He was arrested at the end of it. But they got him to admit to helping Stephen Avery kill Teresa and then burn her body. And at the end of that video, his mother comes into the room, and this is on video, and he says to her that I told them things that weren't true. He's almost immediately admitting that he just made stuff up to get them off his back. But the gist of what he ends up confessing to in the police interrogations, which happened a couple of months later, is that he went to Stephen Avery's trailer around 8:15 p.m. So that would be 30 minutes after they were seen at the bonfire by his mom. That he went to Avery's trailer at 8:15 p.m. and that he saw Teresa restrained to Avery's bed, that he helped take her to the garage. They stabbed her and they shot her 5 times there around 8:30. Then they put her body in her Jeep, but then decided not to use the Jeep to move it. And then they moved her out of the Jeep and into the burn pit and burned her up instead. That is what he confessed to. And absolutely, it was entirely coerced and probably completely false. So at 9:30 p.m., we know there's another phone call. Avery's girlfriend, Jody, again calls him from the prison, and they speak for another 15 minutes. And that's kind of the end of the day. It seems like we don't have many statements for beyond what happened that evening. But basically, Teresa Halbach is never seen alive again after October 31st. She doesn't show up for work the next couple of days, so her employer calls the family, and her ex-boyfriend and family is trying to contact her, but her voicemail is full. So on November 3rd, her mother files a missing persons report.
And then the circus begins.
Yeah, and the circus begins.
You can just tell things aren't going to go well, that these investigators felt confident enough to actually make an appearance. It's just so stupid. Like, why would you do this? If you have personal interest, like a very direct personal interest in the outcome of an investigation, as in you're being sued by the guy, and you've also falsely convicted him before of a crime he didn't commit, you don't go to the scene. You don't show up. You don't do anything to risk your possible future conviction. And they didn't care. They were happy to have the integrity of their case impeached by their mere presence, which suggests either they are completely reckless, incompetent, and stupid, or they had a really strong motivation to be there anyway.
Yeah. So what happened was the missing persons case was filed with Calumet County, which is where her mother called, and they called Manitowoc for assistance. And so for Manitowoc to get involved, considering there's like this pending huge lawsuit, the wrongful conviction, all the shady stuff that's happened, either a big mistake or deliberate.
Yeah, and Manitowoc does not get the benefit of the doubt here. I mean, that was the whole point of them not being involved in the investigation, to avoid this from happening. So that if, say, some kind of unfortunate coincidence happens that could possibly be construed to point at police misconduct, they could rule that out because they weren't there. So if that unfortunate coincidence did happen, well, too bad. You are on the hook for every unfortunate coincidence, it looks like police misconduct, that happens, because you were at the scene when you shouldn't be. And boo-hoo. I mean, the fact they're complaining about that now, it's mind-boggling to me.
You know, in Adan's case, we have the NCIC results that show that Hayes' car's plates have been run, and we don't know what that means to this day. And something similar happened here, where the same day she is reported as missing, there's a call to dispatch from Sergeant Andrew Colburn of Manitowoc County. And he calls dispatch and he says, can you run this plate for me? She runs a plate, confirms that it's related to a missing person. And he asks, is it a 99 Toyota? And the dispatch confirms. When he's confronted with this call at trial, and he's asked, why did you ask for this specific plate to be run? And would you have known this information just off the top of your head? And he said, no, I wouldn't have known. And he had no explanation. He's like, I don't know how I knew this information. He was asked, did you find the car? Were you standing next to the car running these plates? And he said, no, but he also had no explanation for why he made that call and the information that he had and that he knew it was a 99 Toyota.
You know, there's no way to solidly answer. You can't answer it. Based on what's there, it could go either way.
How would you explain it innocently?
There are additional facts we don't know about when people got involved in the investigation or what their roles were. I don't know enough to say. I mean, that alone to me, it's not proof. But again, this is why they should not have been anywhere near this investigation in any capacity, because they don't get the benefit of the doubt. That's why they were supposed to not be there, is because if something like this happened, I think it is fair to say there's a real possibility. And in light of what happened later, it's reasonable to draw an inference that something was going on with where the car was, how it was found, and how it ended up back on the lot. Then we have the car magically show up. A volunteer found it under somewhat strange circumstances.
Yeah.
And that it's a giant sprawling car lot, and she zeroes in on it pretty quick. And plus the whole way it had like wood laid against it, that's so weird.
It was like the saddest.
Regardless of how the car got there.
Saddest cover-up job ever.
It was like a look at me cover-up job.
Yeah. But here's the thing. So that happened 2 days later on the 5th of November. But on the 4th of November, they actually had helicopters do flyovers of the entire lot numerous times, and her car wasn't found. And there were volunteers at that point, like civilian volunteers who were canvassing the area, spreading out flyers. So they do this flyover, they find nothing. Stephen Avery gives a couple of reports to media, and he seems like calm. He's like, I don't know what's going on. And every point of the way gives police permission and people permission to come and look at his property. And he had allowed them to search the trailer. So on the 4th, the helicopters don't find anything. And you can even find footage online of some of the helicopter flyover, and it's very open. So it's not like it's a wooded area where they wouldn't have seen it. I think they would have seen it if it was there. The morning of the 5th, the circumstances in which this volunteer, who apparently is a lapsed private investigator, found the car are pretty suspicious. First, because that search only took place because all of a sudden, early in the morning, somebody at Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department said, you know what, we want to go back and look at the lot again. And they sent volunteers in. Like you said, in 15 minutes, this woman found the car. And the car didn't have, like, you know, so if you're going to make the argument that maybe the helicopters couldn't see it, the car had like these twigs in different places around. It was totally visible, but it didn't have anything on top. So a helicopter still should have been able to spot it.
It's a lot of cars there. They could have missed it. I mean, you would think the fact that one of them was circled with like twigs would have made it more likely they'd spot it, but I can see them missing it.
Actually, that's true. That's almost like it's actually being pointed out to you on a map. Look at this car circled by twigs. So the car had some interesting things going on inside of it. There was blood found in different points on the car, and there was blood found, I think, by the key ignition and a few places up front, and then there were drops of blood found in the back of the car, like the trunk area. The car battery was disconnected. I don't know why or what that means. It was there. It was just disconnected. The blood marks in the front by the ignition and I think a couple other places were Stephen Avery's, and the drops in the back of the car were Teresa's.
You mentioned earlier that Stephen Avery had gone and done interviews with the press and whatnot and seemed calm throughout it. But in some of those, it was very clear he had a cut in his hand. I mean, I think the guy even zoomed in on it. So it's not like it was a secret that he had a cut on his right hand, on one of his fingers. Someone was saying, well, if the cops couldn't have planned the blood, how would they have known that he had a cut right there to match up with where it was in the ignition? I mean, they should have watched the news. It wouldn't have been difficult. And yes, it's a very extreme thing to contemplate that cops might go as far to plant blood on a crime scene. But one, given the history here and the fact they're there when they shouldn't have been, kind of ruins any sort of assumption against that. And two, the way it's there looks planted. It doesn't look at all the way you'd expect blood to fall or blood to be.
What do you mean by that?
Just the way it was, like, there was nothing he would have touched directly. There was no, like, smear mark blood. Like, it was a cut in his hand. So you get blood on stuff by picking stuff up or, like, touching those limbs they decided to scatter around the car. I mean, you get smeared blood, not nice little, like...
drops.
Blood paints, like, blood calligraphy.
Squiggles.
Like, how does he put blood next to ignition and yet not put blood on the steering wheel?
Well, I mean, the other thing is this, you know, for somebody, like, if you're going to assume that he did it, if for somebody who took such pains to, like, destroy the body, I mean, like, burning it to, like, just little bone fragments and teeth, you think he would have, like, wiped down the car. I mean, this is my thing. I mean, you know, you kill somebody, you burn the body in your own front yard, and then you park the car on your own property without even wiping it down. It just, I'm not saying there aren't stupid criminals. I'm just saying, I don't know, it's hard to understand. Now, the interesting thing about the blood drops to me in Teresa's car are that I don't think her blood is found anywhere else. The state says he killed her in the garage. There's no evidence of Teresa's DNA in that garage, except for there was...
Oh, the DNA on that very conveniently. The story is that Stephen shot her in the head. The bullet went through her head all the way through, nicely wedged itself in a pre-existing crack in the ground, which the odds seem astronomically against it. But on that bullet that was, like, nicely wedged into this little crack just so it conveniently stay there, and there was no blood in the crack, no blood anywhere, it has some DNA from her on it, supposedly.
Yeah, and apparently it was a bullet fragment. It wasn't the entire bullet. They found a lot of casings, but this is the only bullet that was found. It wasn't even a whole bullet. And the other thing is that the DNA testing done on it, apparently the crime lab person had used whatever DNA material she had of Teresa's. She had used the entire sample, but she had inadvertently contaminated the test with her own DNA. So the test was invalidated and she couldn't redo the test because she had no more material, no more DNA material to test it against. But here's the thing, if he shot her, and I think the state said that he shot her like 11 times in the garage, there would be blood.
Wait, really? I didn't know that. Why so many?
They actually got Brendan Dassey to say, you know, he shot her 11 times and then I think he changed it to 5 times. But the point is he'd shot her apparently multiple times according to the official story. But even if he shot her once, there would have been like blood sprayed all over the place. I mean, even these microscopic drops of blood probably would have been found in parts of the garage that nobody could have even seen. Like, you know, if he was going to be cleaning his garage, he wouldn't have even seen it.
Also, he didn't clean his garage. Just look at the ground. Like, it was filthy. There was no cleaning done. Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the recent developments, is that Kathleen Zellner apparently has asked for advanced luminol testing of the garage and the house. And luminol, it's a chemical, and it reacts with certain substances, including hemoglobin and blood. So that luminol testing, I guess, will come to light pretty soon. If that comes back negative, that there's not a positive reaction there, it'll be interesting to see what that means in terms of a claim of actual innocence.
But I think that even the police agree she didn't actually die there, right? They don't believe Brendan's story. I mean, they don't use Brendan at Stephen's trial.
I think they did go with this. I think they went with, he shot her in the garage. I don't know if they said he put her body in the trunk of the car briefly or not, or like how they explained her blood being in the trunk. And the other thing is this, you know, you can't date the blood, right? I mean, like there could be, for example, like my blood in my car from something, right? I mean, or my daughter who routinely cuts herself since she's a kid. So if they found that blood there, to me, there's no evidence that she died in a way that would even mean she bled. She could have been strangled.
I thought they found in the skull fragments, they found evidence of gunshot or entry wounds. So I think it was fairly well established that she died from a gunshot.
Yeah, I'm finding a few references here. In Stephen's trial, the prosecution's case theory is that Teresa was murdered in the garage, thus explaining the lack of forensic evidence in his trailer. So it seems at least a few different locations they're saying that that was literally the theory of the case, that he fatally shot her in the garage. So we'll see. I don't know in terms of what the standard exactly is in Wisconsin, but if that luminol testing comes back negative, it'll be intriguing to see what Zellner argues in that regard. It seems she has a few different options she could pursue with that.
But it's been so long. I mean, that seems kind of meaningless to me. I mean, luminol reacts to all kinds of things. Luminol, it reacts to bleach. If someone's gone and cleaned it since then, I hope they have.
The article references advanced luminol testing. You're right, Susan, that a reaction does not necessarily mean that it was blood. It could be another oxidizing agent, such as chemicals that are in bleach. So a positive could be a false positive. I'm not sure if it's a negative at this point in time. I don't know what's been done in the garage, what they can say, but it's possible that there could be a firm enough conclusion that this was not a murder that took place in the garage. And I don't know exactly how far that would get Zellner in Wisconsin.
I'm still interested in the blood testing. So assuming that blood in the car didn't come from Stephen Avery on October 31st or in the days after, where did it come from? Well, the obvious other option is from the tube of blood that the police had in their possession.
Do you remember why they had that blood? They had a couple of vials of his blood.
From his previous conviction.
From his previous conviction, right? It wasn't... they had collected DNA like samples from like the entire family, Avery family, at the time that Halbach disappeared too. So I wasn't sure if it was from then or...
So with the... I know the big thing at the trial was whether or not they could find EDTA.
Yeah, so his blood was in a blood collection tube that had a purple stopper, and EDTA, it's an anticoagulant, it prevents the blood from coagulating. And the claim here by the state was the blood found in the RAV4 tested negative for EDTA, and therefore it was the FBI agent who was able to say at trial the blood stains collected from the RAV4 could not have come from the EDTA tube. Problem is, and this goes back to what you mentioned before, well, the cuts on Stephen Avery's hand, obviously the famous case is the O.J. Simpson case where he also had the cuts in his hand, and that was one of just a couple of cases where EDTA evidence was at issue. The defense was trying to use EDTA evidence to say this was planted in the O.J. Simpson case. Prosecution here was trying to say your claim the blood was planted can't be true because there's no EDTA. The protocol here was sort of done in a hurry. It hadn't been done since 10 years earlier in the O.J. Simpson case. It was done very hastily. It wasn't done very well or pursuant to the scientific method. So it's tough to draw any firm conclusions, but I'm not sold one way or the other about whether this EDTA evidence is convincing or not. But that's the general theory, is that if this were planted, it should have EDTA based upon the purple stopper, and there wasn't sufficient EDTA in this case to have a positive result.
It is interesting to compare the color of the blood stains from Stephen Avery's blood versus the color of the blood stains from Teresa Halbach's blood, though, because one looks like an old brown blood stain and one is really bright orangey red. The blood calligraphy has a very bright color to it, which, you know, it's about as unscientific as it gets to say that. But at the same time, given everything else, I'm very curious to see if Zellner is able to find an alternative testing. I believe they were looking at some way to age date the blood, as in to find out if that blood was collected when the donor was at a certain age in 1995 or something versus 2005. In other words, if they could find out if the blood was consistent with someone of Stephen's age at the time of Teresa's death or consistent with his age at the time the blood was taken, I think in 95.
I wonder if carbon testing, I mean, isn't like carbon testing used to like date items, artifacts and things of that sort, and old trees and things like that?
1,000-year time scales.
Oh, darn. It wouldn't help us here.
This is a big reason why I didn't delve into this case too much, is I really looked at this and said, this EDTA is the whole case, because if this is legitimately his blood from 2005, he's probably guilty. And if it is planted there, then even beyond what we might think about police corruption, you just can't trust a single thing about the case. And it's not so much a legal analysis, it is a forensic chemist or someone being able to come in and say, this is likely legitimate or this is likely planted. And that, to me, is the linchpin of the entire case. And it's, again, not so much a legal analysis, it's more a scientific analysis.
It was driving me crazy to hear people say there was some framing going on, like things were definitely fishy there, but I think he's probably guilty anyway. When the evidence you have comes from evidence that you admit was probably tampered with by the cops, the fact that it points at Avery is not evidence of his guilt, because of course it does. The police were the ones handling all the data. They're the ones handling all the information that came through.
It's the fruit of the poisonous tree. Yeah, I mean, you can't just remove the taint and say, well, there's probably corruption, but the evidence points to him. Well, no, because the evidence would be the result of the corruption. Again, not to say he's innocent, but to say if you have corruption, all the evidence is tainted in the case. And that includes the Dassey confession. I mean, that's something where 25% of cases, the Innocence Project, where they have DNA evidence proved innocence, involves false confessions. And a big chunk of those are people who are either under 18 or they have developmental disabilities. So whether it's police corruption, whether it is a false confession, there's just so many problems with the evidence here.
I don't know the case near well enough to say whether or not Avery's guilty. You know, Brendan, I feel very strongly he's innocent. I couldn't swear to it, but just from everything I've seen so far, I just have no doubts there. That kid didn't do this. For Avery, I have no idea. I can't say one way or another. But I can't say whether a lot of people in this case are guilty or not. So the fact that he happens to be the one in jail isn't a compelling reason for him to stay there, I guess, for me.
Here's two thoughts I have. Number one, on the police corruption bit, there is video of one of the earlier searches of his home in which I think there's a female officer who is looking through the house. And this is before they actually identified the bloodstains in the car as being his. And she finds on his desk an invitation to an event, like an Innocence Project event where he's going to be speaking. And she actually says, you know, he won't be making it to this event. And then she jokes about taking a pair of his shoes and like implicating him in some burglary or something. So it seems like the police are already starting to circle him, and he is their only suspect. It doesn't seem like they really did an investigation of anybody else. And that's part of the issue in a lot of these kinds of cases where there's tunnel vision and they exclude so many other people. But here's the thing. This is where I stop. Okay, let's say there was no confession by Brendan. Let's say that didn't even exist. Let's say there was no blood. It didn't exist. But what did exist are these bone fragments. The fact that parts of her body, her bone, teeth, were found in his yard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in a burn pit his yard. And then there was a barrel, a burn barrel, that had apparently her camera. And that's the other thing. Is like, you know, we could figure out whose property she had photographed first if we actually had that camera. But the camera, her PDA, and phone were found destroyed, burned, like incinerated in this burn barrel on his property, too.
You know, there was a phone card or a camera SIM card in the car.
I did not know that.
It's in one of the pictures. Yeah. I don't know if they ever looked at it, but I saw it in one of the pictures. I was wondering what was on there.
We should tell Kathleen Zellner.
I'm sure that's been already done.
Yeah. As was so much in the case, recently it came out, there was a claim that the bone evidence is questionable, and it's not certain whether it could be tied to Teresa in this case. So
can it be tied to the property?
Yeah, there's that too.
You're on day 8 of an intensive investigation. You know there are going to be accusations of police tampering, and you respond by failing to take a single picture of the human remains on your prime suspect's property? No. I don't believe it. Like, that doesn't happen. The only circumstance I can imagine where they would not take a single photo of Teresa's body on Stephen Avery's property is if, I guess, the bones were so obviously fake they couldn't risk it, or so obviously planted they couldn't risk it, or if they were never there at all.
It's mind-boggling to consider that they might not have been there at all, and they were somewhere else and the police found them, which is like, how does that happen? But then, you know, Colin, you said that they might not have even been hurt. Like, this is the first time I'm hearing of that, though. I didn't know that there was a question about whether or not they were actually her bones. But the other thing is, and you know,
but why not one photo?
Right. There's not a single photograph. There's not a single photograph of them discovering the remains in the burn pit. I mean, not a photograph, not a video, nothing. It's all they have is boxes. So the pictures are
a box of bones, yeah, that supposedly came from there.
Yeah, that's all they have. And at this time, and Stephen Avery actually left the property, I think a number of days before that. And basically they searched it over and over. So they not just searched the yard, but the trailer and the garage multiple times. I was listening to Real Crime Profile about, you know, they did a number of podcasts on the case, and something Jim Clemente said was interesting. He said, when you get a search warrant, it's limited. It doesn't just give you unlimited access. It's limited for a number of time and area. You go in, you do your work, and you turn the space back over to the family. And the police in this case didn't do that. They just went all over it over and over and over again. And they had many, many opportunities to fudge stuff. There's also one more piece of evidence, a key evidence that the state offers as his guilt, and that is the key that was found in Stephen Avery's bedroom. It was a key to the car. Again, it was found in a really hokey way.
I mean, it's just like everything else in this case. I think it's significant that even though they had an open warrant search as long as they needed and wherever they wanted the property, they didn't start finding stuff till later on. It's almost like they spend the first part of the search, come up empty, And only then do they make these really weird, surprising findings, which is what you'd expect to see if they initially searched and didn't find what they needed.
Yeah, and the key itself, and this is interesting because when the series aired, one of the people watching made a discovery, and I don't know who it was, but said that, you know, there was a picture of Teresa taken, I think just a number of days before she disappeared, in which she's standing by her car holding her keys, and it's like most of us have keys. It's got like multiple keys on it, right? It's like a whole keychain full of all kinds of junk. But the key that was found in his bedroom, and it was found very conveniently behind like a little nightstand bookshelf type of thing, and it was a single key. It was like a single key fob, and that was it. There was no other keys on it. So it seemed like it was a spare key and not the keys she used on an everyday basis. It also had none of her DNA on it, but it did have Avery's DNA on it, apparently.
And again, if Avery is guilty, then those officers are giant idiots for ruining their case by finding obvious evidence that a non-biased agency could have found if they'd left the investigation to them. I mean, their presence ruined that evidence. But again, if it was good evidence, why did it take them to find it?
What about the DNA found on the hood latch of the vehicle? I think, Colin, you wrote about it that I think the state said it was sweat DNA.
Yeah, Ken Kratz, in response to that, was talking about, you know, you're making all these claims about evidence being planted and the confession being false, but this sweat DNA was found on the hood. The problem with that is there's no such thing as sweat DNA. It does contain skin cells, and those skin cells can contain DNA. And so within sweat, you can say, well, there's DNA, but it's not the sweat itself, it's the skin cells. But there's no real test to be able to say, this is DNA that came from someone sweating on the hood versus it being blood or some other bodily substance. And so that's the dispute there, with sweat DNA being an imprecise term and implying that this would have come from sweat as opposed to from something else.
So I think that is kind of the totality of the evidence against Stephen Avery. And, you know, like we discussed, it seems almost every step of the way that evidence was compromised because of the fact that Manitowoc County was heavily involved, the way the evidence was discovered, like in stages, like the bullet fragment wasn't discovered, I think, like until months later in the garage. And this garage had been searched many times before, all of these things. So that's pretty much the totality of the evidence. Now, what's interesting going forward is that we have this famous attorney, Kathleen Zellner, who has exonerated many people, and she's taken on this case, and she's brought up an issue that is kind of very near and dear to Adnan's case, which she says that she thinks can totally help exonerate Stephen Avery, and that is a cell tower ping. I'm not quite sure which ping she's talking about in terms of like the call log, but she says that there's a cell tower ping, and she said this in an interview, and I haven't seen much after that about this, that she said there's a cell tower ping that puts Teresa 12 miles from the property the last time the phone was pinged. She's actually going to be, I think, filing something based on this, but we don't have the totality of documents that she's using. But also, I'm just wondering, when I'm thinking about this, well, what if her phone last pinged before she got to his property, right? What if it never pinged after she arrived there? Like, does that really mean anything unless she can prove that it was, like, much later in the day, like after 3 or 3:30, and it pinged 12 miles away?
This was the first thing I looked at after watching this series. I was like, well, she was on her phone all day. Let's go see what the records show. And I remember being shocked that there was not a single reference anywhere to towers or where towers were. There was nothing. Like, we had a listing of like one of the reports with some tower ID numbers, but no tower locations, nothing. And that seemed like a huge red flag to me, because if cell records can even remotely support some semi-plausible narrative of guilt, the prosecution uses it. So the fact they didn't use it, to me, it seemed like an indication that they couldn't. Because if those records had remotely shown, if the phone never left the Avery's yard, of course they'd have been waving that around. That would have come up. That would have been a huge issue they would have used to make up some story that kind of fit the records. So I found it really weird. And then a little while later, not too long ago, I don't think, Zellner started saying that the cell records are going to be a big issue here. Again, I don't know what data she has, so it's hard to even remotely evaluate this stuff. But I guess theoretically, if Teresa was actually at the Avery's much earlier in the day, like 2 o'clock-ish, I mean, she was covering serious ground. She was covering enough miles where the cell records are valid evidence. But again, it's...
So here's my question to you, Susan. Like, if... I mean, again, we don't... With so much stuff that we don't know about the cell records, like, I mean, did these cell records also have a disclaimer that incoming call evidence is not, you know, valid for location? Or does Zellner have records that can help triangulate her location? Like, we don't know exactly what they have.
Well, here's the one guess I've got. Okay. Oftentimes, when these towers are given designations, they name them sequentially. at the very start, when they first get the network running, they'll name the tower, like, they'll put 1, 2, 3 in a row. That does break down, because later on they'll add tower 13 and 15 and put them next to 1 and 2. So you can't really follow that necessarily. And for all I know, Singular didn't do it that way. But usually they do name the towers to have the numbers or the whatever they're doing it to designate towers by. There'll be some sort of pattern to it. And assuming that's the case here, there was a sequence of calls earlier in the day on, like, towers 211 and then another two-digit number. And that's pretty solid until 212 that day, when suddenly we start hitting a 219 series of towers. And then at the 240 call, it goes back to the 211, which could suggest, though, that from early in the day till 1:50 p.m., she's in an area of the county covered by towers with 211 designations. Then if the Avery area, the Avery, like, 12-mile, 10-mile, 20-mile radius, is covered by towers with a 219 designation, that means the last call on her phone at 2:41 p.m., it's back on the 211 towers, which, to me, the first question I had was, like, is this showing that 240, she's booked it back to the 211 land? You know, that's hypothetical based on so many assumptions, but it's something I want to see the answer to.
Okay, here's my question then to you. The 241 call is a incoming call, mm-hmm. and that's the one that puts her back outside of the range that she would have been in, I guess, if she was at the Avery property. But then I'm thinking about our helicopter call.
Well, that was an AT&T issue. That was specifically an AT&T known way with their system and how it operated. Ah. I've never heard of another system having that same problem. They might, but I don't know about it. That's the problem with the records. You don't know if they're complete, what they're showing, what their, like, inherent flaws are, if they record things in different ways, if the data set you're pulling specifically excludes certain kinds of data, which happens sometimes when you get these records, it'll be like everything except for calls that happen on a Tuesday. I'm making that up, but you get the idea. And you'll never know that the records you have, because of the way the system operates, automatically excludes Tuesday calls. And you'll be like, oh, no one called on Tuesday. So again, it's very, very limited what we have here. But for me, it goes back to the fact that the prosecution didn't use it. And the prosecution couldn't use it. That suggests that it is very much contrary to their narrative.
But then going back to, you know, mentioning the helicopter call and the DuPont Circle and all that, I think the best quote on this is again from that Rolling Stone piece by Amelia McDowell Perry, and it's quoting Jerry Grant, who was the cell tower expert who testified for Adnan. And he said that Zellner's claim requires more documentation than is currently available in the evidence file. Quote, I would need to plot all of the cell towers in the area at the time to even attempt to determine what could and could not have happened, Grant explains. Quote, Zellner will also need to put the phone in Habach's hand, and that typically is accomplished with corroborated outbound calls. Even if Zellner is correct that the last tower ping was 12 miles from the salvage yard, Grant continues, quote, remember the cell tower itself may be 12 miles away, but the phone doesn't necessarily have to be right under the cell tower to access it. So I think that sort of underscores, Susan, what you've been saying, which is that the publicly available information is a starting point, but we don't have nearly enough to be able to either corroborate or dispel Zellner's claim that this is the, so to speak, the smoking gun that proves that he couldn't have committed this crime, that she was away from the Avery property at the time.
Although I'll say in this case, I'm a little bit less concerned about proving who had the phone, which is usually important evidence, but if you could prove the phone was 12 miles away, I don't think it matters who's holding it, because that doesn't fit any story the prosecution's come up with.
Right, you'd have to explain.
The phone's there.
Yeah, some type of handoff of the phone at some point, which there's nothing.
And it comes back.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, Zellner did say that she's considering an ineffective assistance claim against the attorneys, Buting and Strang, for not using this evidence in his defense. And in response to that, I believe, I don't know if it was Strang or Buting, but one of them, in response to that, the media said that they seem pretty supportive of her strategy here. And they're like, you know, we think she's onto something. And so they seem open to it if they do get, you know, slapped with an ineffective assistance thing. It sounds like they are willing to go along with it and say, yeah, we missed this.
Well, they might have soon a precedent to be able to cite on the issue. We'll see. If there's any good to come out of this case, it's that both with Avery's overturned first conviction for sexual assault, and this more recent case, it's led to actual and proposed changes in the law. So, for instance, we talked about Dassey and his confession. Well, Wisconsin is currently looking into whether there needs to be a new law that applies with regard to custodial interrogations of juveniles. And there's a few different things that have been considered across the country, jurisdictions like Tennessee and Minnesota. Things such as saying that a minor should have a non-waivable right to an attorney during custodial interrogations. What has been passed in Wisconsin, which is that custodial interrogations of minors have to be recorded. There's also the idea that's being considered that if a minor asks to speak to their parents, that that should be considered tantamount to invoking the right to counsel and that the interrogation has to cease. So those are some of the things connected to Dassey that are being proposed and enacted. What happened after Avery's first conviction was thrown out was actually that the American Bar Association amended its model rules of professional conduct, and it added a section called special responsibilities of a prosecutor, and that places an affirmative obligation on prosecutors to do things like to ensure their advising of the right to counsel, they're not presenting inflammatory arguments to the press, and then ensuring they comply with Brady by turning over material exculpatory evidence. The problem is, and I touched upon this in an earlier episode of Undisclosed, in 2010, the Supreme Court decided a case, Connick versus Thompson, and constructively, that opinion makes it very difficult for there to be any discipline or monetary penalty against a prosecutor or a prosecutor's office, and in fact, just about a month ago, the Innocence Project released a study called Prosecutorial Oversight, a National Dialogue in the Wake of Connick versus Thompson. It looked at 660 cases, and its simple conclusion was this, quote, there are almost no adequate systems in place to keep prosecutorial error and misconduct in check, and in fact, prosecutors are rarely held accountable even for intentional misconduct. I think that through Serial and Making a Murderer, break down all these podcasts and documentaries, the public is starting to see some of this misconduct, and I think it's leading to a call for an overhaul of the ways in which we discipline prosecutors who are bending the law, in many cases breaking it. Another thing that I wanted to know, I'll close with this, is that actually in the wake of Stephen Avery's first conviction being overturned, there was what was called the Stephen Avery Bill. And actually after he was arrested and charged again, it was changed to the Criminal Justice Reform Bill. And one of the things they did, and this goes back to something that when I was discussing with Bill Rankin about breakdown, we were talking about, and that's eyewitness reform. And you think about the old school eyewitness identification scenario, you have a police officer who probably knows who the suspect is, you have six people standing in the lineup, and you have the eyewitness, you know, picking number three or number four out of the lineup. And what happened under the Stephen Avery bill was these changes that many states have started to do across the country, and that is, one, it has to be double blind, the officer doing the lineup can't know who the suspect is. To a sequential lineup where it is you are shown one person, he walks out, the second person walks in, so you're not comparing the features of the various people in the lineup and choosing the best person as opposed to independently assessing each of their features. And then the third part of it is, and this is something that's huge, confirmation bias, is that it used to be a lot of positive feedback when the person picked the right person, and that would tend to solidify a memory. Under this Stephen Avery bill that was passed, it limits officers in what they can say to an eyewitness after they identify someone in a lineup. So, again, there's still a lot of work to be done, and the Innocence Project, other groups are doing that work. But, again, if there's one positive to come out of this case, it's that it's led to the additional scrutiny, it has led to these new laws being passed and proposed, and hopefully the end result is we have a lot fewer cases that look like the Stephen Avery case and more cases that are done by the books and that lead to convictions we can have confidence in.
While Making a Murderer made a fairly strong case for Avery's innocence, pointing out the many discrepancies and red flags in the investigation, just like at the end of Serial, there was no smoking gun that completely exonerated the defendant. Many would agree that Avery and certainly Brendan Dassey didn't get a fair trial. Brendan's prosecution in particular is heartbreaking. The videos of the interrogations and police coercions of him at the age of 16 are shocking. They are truly shocking. Both Stephen Avery and Brendan are said to have IQs of around 70, well below average. The circumstances of their impoverished, abusive upbringing made them in many ways prime targets for the police. Most people will agree that Brendan, who is also serving a life sentence, deserves to come home. On Avery, though, many are conflicted. Now, while Susan and Colin might be undecided on Avery, I am decided. I've seen the evidence that Ken Kratz, the prosecutor at the time, and others with the state have offered after the series ended, and none of it is really convincing to me. Not the fact that Avery blocked his cell number when he called Teresa that morning. Not the changing story of his former girlfriend, Jody, because, surprise, witnesses change stories all the time. And in this case, guess what? She's not the only one. Brad Dassey, Brendan's brother, who had testified that his uncle Stephen had asked him jokingly whether he would like to help move a body, well, he's now changed his tune too, and he's saying that he lied on the stand back in 2006. He thought they were guilty back then. Not so much anymore. So yeah, I think Stephen Avery is not a great person, but I do think he's innocent of this crime. I just cannot fathom that a man who has spent 18 years in prison for something he didn't do, someone on the verge of winning tens of millions of dollars, would not only commit a crime that would lock him up for the rest of his life, but that he would call his victim's employer and ask for her to personally come to his home, that he would park her car on his own property and leave it there as helicopter and foot searches are being conducted, that he would burn her body in his own front yard, and that he'd take a few phone calls while it all happened. I just don't believe it. I think Teresa left the Avery property before 3 p.m., which is why Mrs. Zipperer said that she was at her place as late as 3:30 p.m. That's my personal opinion, and it's based on the fact that there is reasonable doubt stamped all over this thing. Of course, thousands of people still end up in prison, though there is reasonable doubt of their guilt. And that's why we need advocates and organizations who step in to try and correct these wrongs, who take on cases even when there isn't a smoking gun exonerating an innocent person. Organizations like the Center on Wrongful Convictions. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast, Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.